And there we go. The tape is indeed rolling.
We're away.
We're away.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercip. This is Crave. Yes, we're back. The 2017 model. The podcast dedicated to film and music, theatre and television, anything that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and I lately.
Now, Happy New Year to you, Simon.
And to you.
And I think we possibly need a diversion from the atrocities happening across the world, in particular in the United States. We're not even going to mention what's going on over there. Instead, we're going to focus on some fantastic and some less fantastic films, from the serious, from the brilliant, to the utterly drivel.
We've got it all. We cover the market here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of the ones we're talking about today are true brilliance. Some come under the heading of "We see them, so you don't have to."
Well, that covers everything.
It does. So, I mean, on the one hand, we've got the most fantastic, stirring, inspirational, true life saga of Lion.
We have, which takes, I have to say, that overused term tearjerker to staggering new heights.
Oh dear Lord, doesn't it just?
We've also cast our critical eye over a film which is acclaimed and it has won a big award. It's called Moonlight. It's a black gay drama, which we will, I think, largely but not totally agree up on, Mr. McCabe.
Indeed. I think you'll find, obviously, that, you know, I'm obviously the one who knows what he's talking about on that one.
Obviously, yeah. You know,
I think I can claim a few extra brownie points here, simply because I took one for the team, and I went to see Monster Trucks.
What a title.
Yeah, you didn't see. Bullets were dodged by you there, weren't they, mate? Seriously.
This was, in case you're not aware of that, very much... a kids' movie, you know, aimed for the holidays, and there was another, quite a few of them at this time of year. Of course, another we've both seen was one which would certainly appeal to many New Zealanders: Moana of the Pacific. We both caught that one.
A vastly superior effort, I think we can agree on that one.
Yeah.
Now, on the music front, I've been a bit slack lately, but I understand you've been catching up on classic music, haven't you? Nick Cave has been in town.
Yeah, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, a band I've heard for, gosh, it must be decades, Steve. This guy's been around for a long time. You know, I've never seen, not only have I never seen him live, this is a terrible thing to admit to, but I'd never really sat down and listened to an album of his. So I had this idea of his, an image of a tall, brooding, sort of thinking man's, punkish sort of a guy. What a better way of putting him. But I had never heard him. So I saw him at the Victor Arena in Auckland last week. I was impressed. I'll tell you more about that in a bit. But we better get on to all the cinematic fare that we're dealing with, Steve. Now, Lion. Let's start with the good stuff. Lion. People have been raving about this with good reason.
It's a fantastic, fantastic film with... I mean, put it this way, if somebody had pitched the story as fiction, would it even have got made?
There's a question.
I mean, what a story. You've got the story of a young 7-year-old boy out in the wilds of India, separated from his brother, finds himself alone on a train into Calcutta. He's... trying to navigate the mean streets of Calcutta on his own at the age of 7, not even speaking a word of Bengali, not even knowing what the language is called.
Yeah.
And through those bizarre series of circumstances, he finds himself being adopted by a couple from Tasmania. That right there would be a questionable premise for a film, if you try pitching it as fiction.
But it doesn't end there.
It barely even starts there.
Yes.
20 years later, this young lad, Saru Brierley, is his new name. He never even had a surname in India. Finds himself playing with what's at that point a fairly new invention, Google Earth. And this becomes an obsession for him, understandably, as he's trying to find his home. And through massive, obsessive internet research and Google Earthing, he finds the town he came from.
Yeah, it's amazing. And he finds the town he's desperate to find, his natural mother and hopefully that brother. And so This is a story told over a couple of hours, Steve, and we won't get into all the detail of the ending, but
no.
I would say, and you'll easily pick up on this on any comments you read or posters you read about this film, that you'll say it, they'll tell you it's an emotional ending. It truly, truly is. And I found myself incredibly caught up in it. And I think before we get into the details of the movie, I just want to say, Steve, you know, when you get to a certain age, you've seen a bit of life, you've seen a bit of loss in your life. And if you have, scenes like this in the film can resonate incredibly powerfully. So I don't mind telling you, I had more than one or ten tears rolling down my cheeks at the end, such as the force of the story, the force of the story, and the superb way it's put together. So let's talk about the superb way it's took together. Can we start with those beginning scenes you'd mentioned, Stephen, the young little lad? He was played by a little boy called Sonny Pawar.
Yes.
And he was incredible, I thought. Totally engaging.
Yeah, I mean, it's something of a commonplace. Anytime you have a small child like that playing a somewhat powerful role, it's just assumed that you'll say, oh, it was an astonishing performance by the young child. It's, okay, you just took a young child in front of a camera. No, there was something about the way he managed to capture, to begin with, hope, that then descended into fear and desperation, and he actually managed to go on that journey. And you know, I mean, the boy's what, 7 years old?
Yeah.
My God, he was brilliant, wasn't he?
He was very, very good. And the way they told this, I think, was helped a lot. I mean, this is a sweeping drama. There's a good dose of emotional music that carries you along the way, but not all the time. And there were a lot of scenes in that early sequencing where they leave out all the music and really just let you sit there and hear the sounds of the city and what this little lad is going through. I found that a very clever way of telling that part of the story. You really get a sense of the caring between little Saru and his older brother, Gudu, and the terrible wrench of their separation, but for both of them. And you just also get a sense of the size of India and how it would be so easy for a little fellow to be just completely lost in a big, big city like Calcutta. And the fact that he managed to dodge all the dangers in front of him, and you know that you're told early on this is based on a true story, it makes it all the more compelling.
It would have been very easy, I think, to make a very mawkish, very...
Yeah.
Sentimental and obviously tear-jerky kind of film, but Garth Williams, to his eternal credit, has filmed this with honesty, and so you've got, you know, we talked about Sonny Pawar, who is the young Saru for the first half of the film. It's worth mentioning the first half of the film, all the dialogue is in either Hindi or Bengali.
Yep, and it doesn't matter a jot.
No, it doesn't. But in fact, I'd say, if anything, it draws you in because it reminds you, you know, this is a film about being lost and being alienated. Yeah, it's good for us to be on the outs a little bit. This was not a world that we had access to.
No.
And it's filmed with love and joy that then, as I say, descends into darkness. And then,
yep.
And then next thing you know, you're looking at Dev Patel.
Yes.
And it's so brilliant is his performance as the young adult Saru that you don't even question his increasingly shonky Australian accent.
Yeah, I know. That's fair. That thought flicked across my mind too, but it didn't really matter.
No, because everything about his performance was so engaging.
It was. And again, he and the other adult characters, they're not overplayed.
No.
It almost has a slightly... At times, it feels a bit like a docudrama, doesn't it? I mean, I thought the two parents, David Wenham and in particular Nicole Kidman, played their roles with a lot of integrity, not overplayed, just absolutely felt utterly real. So you're just taken along the journey. It really... it's hard not to recommend this very, very highly. And you just know that Without spoiling it for you, there's a sequence at the end there which will, I suspect, stay with you, or could stay with you for a long time.
If it doesn't have you welling up inside, then you are a cold, cold, horrible Matt person.
Not to put too fine a point on it, Mr. McCabe.
Well,
No, no.
I'm sorry. I came out of this film thinking, I don't know, I'm going to see a better film this year. It was genuinely that good. I mean, there's one sequence where Saru is talking to his mother, Sue Brierley. And they're talking about, how on earth this family ever came together and how it stayed together. And there's some of the most wonderful close-up scenes of Nicole Kidman describing the pain and the joy that went hand in hand in being Saru's mother. And it's some of the most astonishing acting I've ever seen.
I agree with that. She was utterly masterful.
And there was no attempt to overplay it. That could have been in the wrong hands with the wrong actor and the wrong director. That could have been horrendously overblown and dramatic. And you could imagine a lesser actor having to stomp around the room and wave their hands around. But there was the tight, controlled pain and joy in every single word she spoke. I don't think I've seen a scene like it in a long time.
I think I utterly agree. I actually walked out of the film, and I almost had to sort of take a few breaths along the way just to sort of, gather myself. And I'm not, without turning it into just a dealing totally with the emotion, but I mean, I just, for example, I mean, I lost my parents not that long ago, so films like this can bring back some of those emotional reactions in an audience, depending on what's happened to you in your life. And this, because it does it in a very a way with integrity and honesty, and as you say, not overplayed, Steve, it just cuts to you pretty sharply, pretty quickly, and deeply. So I think, take a packet of tissues with you and buy a ticket.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Do go now. Like, pause the podcast, go and see it now, and then come back and listen to the rest of it. It's that good.
It is that good. Okay,
Yes.
well, it's hard for us not to disagree on that. That was great.
Now,
Now,
speaking of films that aren't that good.
Oh, yes.
I'm sorry, I had to do that.
You did, yeah.
Let's go to the moonlight, shall we?
All right, because actually, Steve, you just said something in chatting about Lion, about a film taking you to a culture you're not that knowledgeable of, like this,
Yes.
you mentioning about India. Well,
Yes.
actually, the same thing for me applied to Moonlight. Moonlight is it's about a young black boy who is gay, and it charts his early life from a little lad through to a teenager and then an adult as he comes to understand his sexuality. And the film, it's based in Miami, in the sort of set in the a neighborhood riddled with drugs, takes you to that world. Now, I'm probably like you, not very familiar with black American gay culture, so there was a bit of a learning curve there for me. I overall liked it and wanted to and cared about what happened to the main character, is the character called Chiron. I don't think overall you would join me in that, well, I think. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair assessment. It left me completely cold.
Completely cold. Whoa, don't hold back. Okay, tell me why.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the structure of the film, perhaps.
Yep.
It's told in three acts.
Yep.
Each act named after one of the names that people in Chiron's life give him. And in the first act, we see this young lad, primary school kind of age.
Yep.
And in stark contrast with the way in which Saru Brierley is played by Sonny Pawar in Moonlight, as in Lion, I beg your pardon, I found that the depiction of, well, Little, as he's referred to, by Alex Hibbert, was blank. He has very, very few lines to give, and the ones he does are delivered in something of a deadpan. He's got a blank look on his face as he is finds himself in the orbit of a somewhat questionable character named Juan. And this is an issue that I have with the film in general. Most of the male characters in the film are drug dealers, and so Juan's a drug dealer, because let's face it, all black men are drug dealers, right? No attempt to develop that character at all. He's a drug dealer, but the difference is he's a drug dealer with a heart of gold, of course he is. So he, for some reason, takes in little. We've got no idea what his motivations are, other than he's that thing that you often see in films where the protagonist is white. He's the magical Negro friend, the character that exists solely to advance the protagonist's interests. We don't know why he takes him in. Frankly, I'd find a middle-aged man taking a small boy in a little bit dodgy.
Yeah, okay, I'll just quickly say, I will say to you, I had that question in my mind too about Juan, who's played by a pretty established actor, Mahershala Ali, I think I got his name right, who's a good actor. I also, Steve, didn't really think I knew why he did that, given he's a guy who peddles a lot of misery on the streets of his neighborhood. He's willing to take a young fellow in to... I didn't get the motivation. And the thought that he might be some sort of predator did occur to me, because you just wonder where the story's going to take you. But anyway, yes, carry on, sir.
We also have his woman, Teresa, played by Janelle Monáe, who is again something of a cliched, the standard issue sassy black woman character, bit one dimensional. Okay, there's no clue whatsoever to their motivations, to their interest in this child. They just take him in because, you know, that's what drug dealers do, isn't it? You know, we know that drug dealers are among the most altruistic members of any given community.
Yeah, I mean, for example, you wonder whether did they have a problem? Had that? Were they not able to have their own kids? There's no scenes of any other children in the house, so maybe he's some sort of surrogate child to them. But that's never explained in any way. You're just left to guess at that.
Exactly.
And they live in this sort of what looks like an incredibly well-to-do middle-class home.
In the middle of Liberty City in Miami, one of the most depressed areas in the state.
So there are some incongruities there that I also found a little troubling. But anyway, that was the first act. So, yes.
Yeah. And we also get to see Chiron's mother, Paula, played by Naomi Harris. Mm-hmm. Again, descend into cliche. She starts off in one scene, she's a nurse, because that's what any black woman aspires to be, apparently, in popular media. But then she goes to the other available career trajectory for a black woman. She becomes a crack whore.
Of course she
does. Yeah. Disappointingly, there's no attempt, again, to give her any kind of... this is a big problem I have with the entire film. It's not so much character arcs as character polygons. They just dart from isolated point to isolated point with no sense of how they got from one place to another. We don't know what took her from having a career to simply selling her body for her next hit of crack. But that's what we're given.
Yeah, I think sounds like I'm just going to agree with you all the time, but I do agree.
I do agree. This film.
You know, I'm going to tell you why.
You see, I told you I was right.
In a minute, but I think with that character, the character of Teresa, Chiron's mother, it did feel like a bit of a caricature, because it felt like a good actor taking on this role. We've all seen Naomi Harris, you know, around the world as Money Penny in the James Bond movies. She's a talented actor, but it just there's one scene that struck me, and I think you noticed it as well. Early on, when we see her with her little son Chiron as a primary school kid, she's admonishing him over something, and they're at home in the lounge, and she's telling him, "You gots to do this. You gots, G-O-T-S. You gots to do this." And then
didn't that feel so shoehorned in, didn't it?
It did. And then within 5 seconds, she's telling him about his TV rights being revoked.
Yeah.
And I thought, you're using that word revoked and gots. It's like, what language are we? What's the language we're talking here? It seemed all mishmash, and I know it's just a little sing, but it just it didn't ring true, and it did jar with me, I've got to say. And yeah, we don't really know why, how she turned to that path, why she did. So on these aspects, I'm agreeing with you, Steve.
Well, I'm it's because I'm right. But then let's move on to the middle movement.
Yes.
Where he's a high school boy. Now, I found this to be the most compelling part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
There was actual career, not career, character and story development. This is where he has his sexual awakening. It's where he actually encounters hardship and challenge and deals with them. And this is the only time when you really see a meaningful development in Chiron as a character.
Mm-hmm.
So it's played reasonably well. Ashton Sanders plays teenage Chiron for this section. Juan's disappeared at this point. We've got no idea where he's gone. He served, like I say, magical black friend. He served his purpose. He's advanced the protagonist. Now he's simply neglected, and we don't really know why. But again, we don't really know what's going on within the world. We're simply given this one little episode within Chiron's life. Without any context to it.
Yeah, I mean, but the purpose of that middle segment, and maybe the reason why it is the most engaging, is that it is the time when he is confronted directly as someone in puberty with his sexuality. It's where he meets there's an important character, Kevin, excuse me, and so who becomes important later on in the film as well. So that awakening has to be an important part of the story. I just wanted very quickly, Steve, back to your concern about the young lad played by Alex Hibbert. I didn't have such a problem with that, just because I think some little boys talk and some little boys don't.
I can accept that.
It didn't worry me that he was at times just quiet and internal. That just felt like that could have been how a little boy might have reacted to some idea that he was different than most of the other boys around him in some way that he didn't really understand yet. But those other reservations, I'm with you on that. What about the third act when he's a full-grown man?
When he's a full-grown man, and again, very disappointingly, he's a black man, so what does he do? Oh, that's right, he's a drug dealer, isn't he? Of course he is, because, that's what black men do. We don't know how he fell into that, other than the obvious cliche, he's a black man, therefore. We find that he's moved from Miami to Georgia, to Atlanta. We don't know why. His mother is now apparently in rehab.
Yeah.
Which that's nice. That must have a good insurance policy that's paid for her rehab. We're not quite sure where. We're given very little detail other than the fact that he doesn't answer her phone calls as often as a good lad should.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets a phone call out of nowhere from Kevin.
Yes. Yes. Some things I quite liked about that final sequence. He starts in the movie as a little quiet internal guy. In the third act, he is again a very quiet internal person.
Yes, you're right.
What he has done in the meantime, and we get, you're right, we're not told this, but we guess that prison. I've given something away. Damn.
You did. I think you mentioned that. No, that's right. You mentioned that when we were speaking off the air. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. That was not part of our internal monologue,
was
it?
Pretend you have. No. Something's happened to him. Let's just say that he's become a powerful physical man.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And I thought that was significant in the story, that maybe this was how he was kind of protecting himself in a way from the world, perhaps. So that I didn't mind that part. I just quickly, Steve, I think overall I had quite a few reservations, and I'm not disagreeing with a lot of what you're saying, but I just thought one thing struck me, like I bought into the story enough, and I cared about what was going to happen to Chiron enough, that the fact that I knew that I didn't really know that much about black gay American culture. I'm a middle class white straight New Zealand guy, but I still cared about what happened to him. So I felt there's something going on there in the performance of the main character mainly, and the arc of the story mainly. And because this was something that was a little new to me, and maybe I was a little bit surprised that I cared about him as much as I did, that I wanted to, that I bought into it to that degree. I think it does have flaws, but I'm glad I saw it.
I wish I could find the same enthusiasm that you find. I mean, I understand that not being black and not being gay, I am not part of that community, and this film was not speaking to me. It wasn't attempting to speak to me. And yes, I'm sure that were I part of that community, I would be sitting there going, I'm so glad to see myself on the cinema screen, because it's not a community that often gets depicted. Let's face it.
Yeah.
And on that level, yeah, it works. But in the same way, I'm also not an Australian adopted lad of Indian heritage.
No.
But I found myself drawn in Lion in a way that I wasn't in Moonlight. And I mean, you could make the case that Gareth Williams expressly intended to make a film that spoke to the general population, whereas it's entirely possible that Barry Jenkins decided to write and direct a film with no interest in addressing people other than the people he was depicting.
Ooh, yeah, but I think a story that deals with a young child separated from their family and wanting to find out about that family a long time later has an appeal that goes beyond any gender or sexuality. That would appeal to, I mean, that's any person on the planet might feel something about that. But as you say, the great majority of people probably know about their sexuality at some point and are comfortable, or straight people are comfortable in it. But maybe this film, Moonlight, was just trying to say, hey, that for a lot of people that isn't the case, and this is what it might be like for one of them. And so that's
okay,
I think they're quite different tableaus there. I think
I can take that. I can accept that most definitely.
Anyway. Okay.
So would you recommend that other non-gay, non-black people buy a ticket?
I actually would. I would, because I think I don't think it's a great film in terms of just the filmmaking and the story. There are some problems with it, but I found, hey, I am drawn into a story here that I didn't necessarily expect I would be, and yeah, I got something out of this. I cared about the character, which is the most important thing. So yeah, I would buy a ticket, and I would recommend you buy a ticket. So we'll agree to disagree on that one.
I'm afraid we're going to have to, because I mean, let's face it, you did agree with very nearly everything I said.
Except the important stuff.
Except the important stuff. Fair enough, I'll take that.
Okay, so that was Moonlight. So, where are we? We've dealt with the serious stuff. What about some lighter fare, Steve?
Well, let's find one that we can absolutely agree on.
Okay. Well, as we've been saying, it's what we laughingly refer to as summer in New Zealand. It hasn't been a great one, but one way in which kids can be entertained over the summer is with all the raft and raft of
I see what you did there.
Yeah, raft of holiday movies that are on offer, and one of them deals with, of course, a type of raft, a waka, in many of them, and this is the Disney take on Pacific culture, Steve. It's called Moana.
Yes.
Animated, been out for a few weeks now. Probably most of you have had a chance to see it. We both had. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was visually wonderful. It shone a light on Pacific culture for the rest of the world to see, and that's a good thing. It was an interesting blend of different Pacific cultures, I think. I think I saw it in the credits at the end, Steve. They consulted a variety of different island nations and cultural groups to sort of come up with a blended Pacific character.
Yes.
And they took, though, a mythological character, Maui, who's obviously appears in many different island Pacific Island nations as the way to tie it all together. The plot basically is about how Moana, a young girl, a princess, growing up on an island where her father, voiced by Temuera Morrison, is saying, look, you can't go out there beyond the reef. We have to look after our own here on our island. There's some environmental threat, though, to their existence, to their crops, to the fish, that needs to be addressed. Moana thinks she needs to go out beyond the atoll, the reef, to find an answer, that somehow Maui can help her find the answer to this. And the story follows that journey. It's quite an interesting mix, Steve, of real life adventure, if I can say it that way, and mythological events and characters. It blends mystical and real in a way that might be, for some young kids, might be, I don't know, could be a bit challenging perhaps. It's in a way, it's kind of a serious, there's quite a serious environmental theme running there, but there's a lot of character in Maui and Moana, both really well-developed characters, and entertaining, and it takes you on a, it was really, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I'm going to have to agree with everything you said there. I mean, visually, it's spectacular. It's some of the most astonishing photorealistic animation I've seen ever, I think. The character of Moana is beautifully played by Auli Carvalho, who, a young Hawaiian girl, who gets to play that rarest of things. She denies the character being a princess, but obviously, you know, this is a Disney cartoon, so obviously she's a princess. In fact, Maui does point out to her, so look, you've got an animal for a sidekick. Of course you're a princess. So nice little bit of meta reference to the genre. But she is a strong, independent character. There's no love interest.
No, there's no
depending upon being saved by. In fact, we probably shouldn't go too far down that path. But there's no sense whatsoever that she needs to be saved by a male character.
No,
she drives the story herself. She is a strong, independent woman character, and this is breaking the mold of years and years and years of insipid Disney princesses.
Well put, sir. No, that's absolutely correct. She utterly drives the story, and in a very culturally affirming way. And what I mean by that is one of the things that really struck me about this, and the way in which it really, obviously they did spend a lot of time talking to various communities. Do you know, one thing I noticed through the film, Steve, was the way in which Moana stood up and said who she was and where she came from.
Oh, repeatedly,
repeatedly. I am Moana. I am from, was it Motunui, I think was the island. And I am here to do this. You know, and that's a very important statement of who you are, where you're from, and what you're there to do. Done in a way that you would possibly see on a marae, I guess, around New Zealand or in other Pacific Island nations. And it tapped into a Pacific sensibility and a sense of humor too. I noticed there are a couple of quite, you mentioned the reference about the animals, a funny little reference about how trailing her hand in the water off the waka, why the water temperature changed was funny and just very typical. And so it was quite accurate in that sort of way. And I don't think it was, I wasn't surprised at the end of the film. I saw it during the day and was a bunch of parents with younger kids. And I think there were a mixture of different nationalities in the audience. There was quite a round of applause at the end.
Yes.
And I wasn't surprised at it. I think there's a lot to, people, in our part of the world anyway, people gained a lot from it.
I mean, it's been a good year for Kiwi film, to be fair. I sent a DVD of Hunt for the Wilder People to my family in England as a Christmas present, and they universally raved over it. They couldn't stop saying enough good things. But we're not seeing a huge amount, usually, of high-end Kiwi films. But let's face it, this was a high-end Kiwi film. It might have a Disney imprint on it, but look at the cast list.
Yes. Yeah, I mentioned Temuera Morrison. You've got another very well-established New Zealand actor, Rachel House, and she plays the grandmother, which was a very important role in the film.
There's obviously a Concord in there.
There is Jermaine Clement, who plays an over-the-top, again, mystical crab creature, and sings a great song.
Go ahead.
And there's also a quick little role, but he's got such a distinctive voice, it's hard not to pick him out. Oscar Keitley turns up early on as one of the village members there, he's there, and we all would have, a lot of New Zealanders would have picked up his voice. So, it had a very strong sense of Aotearoa running through it there. It blended with the American voices, which I thought I might have found it quite jarring, but I think most of us know that Dwayne Johnson, who voiced Maui, is himself of a Pacific heritage, Hawaiian, I think it is.
Yes.
And so that didn't seem to matter, really. And of course, you know, in Hawaii, they'll speak their language with an American accent. So, hey, you know, it doesn't matter. I think it would be interesting, Steve, though. I wonder if someone in... We were just talking about, you know, looking at a film about India or looking at a film set in Miami. If you were in Miami or in India, how you would have looked at that story.
Yeah. I mean,
the other way around. I don't know.
I would suggest, if we're going to find any criticisms of Moana, and let's face it, it's not a perfect film. It's a very, very good film, but it's not a perfect film. And I did find, as you hinted at earlier, it's not uniquely, let's say, a Maori film, and it's not uniquely a Samoan film. It's a Polynesian film.
Yes.
And there is a degree to which they kind of did a little bit of a grab bag of a bit of your Maori stuff and a bit of Samoan stuff, or stick a bit of Tongan stuff and a bit of Hawaiian stuff, and we'll see what comes out in the wash. And it wasn't always entirely clear what the identity was. It was assortedly Polynesian, in the same way that you would never make a European film, because we're acutely aware of all the different nationalities of Europe. But there was a tiny degree to which they simply lumped Polynesia in as one, which made me a little bit uncomfortable.
Oh, okay. I had a slightly different take on that, because I thought, particularly because the film, part of the story of the film is about the way in which the people of that island navigated their way across the Pacific.
Yeah.
And that's how, as far as we understand it, that's how all the Pacific nations, including New Zealand, were first encountered by the Polynesian people. That the film was almost... on purpose, giving you a sort of a hybrid Pacific culture to, as a representative, to talk about the whole settlement of this vast ocean. So it was kind of like I thought that seemed to me to be a deliberate thing that they were doing, so that they weren't going to pigeonhole themselves as Tongan or Samoan or Niuean or Hawaiian or New Zealand or whatever. But I hear what you're saying. If you were looking for a particular geographical reference point for this island, you might have been a bit mixed up by that, because it wasn't absolutely clear in that sense.
But at the same time, though, I think were I a young Maori filmgoer and I saw the waka emerging from the cave, and I saw the islanders performing a haka in celebration of it, I would be thinking, about bloody time.
Yeah, I agree with you. That really stirred me to see that. And I was thinking, man, this is... I don't have a drop of Pacific blood in me, but I've grown up in this country, so I feel some sort of ownership in a loose way to that. And so to see that, it made me feel good. It made me feel like, hey, world, here we are. This is part of who we are down here, and yeah, here's one of our stories.
And there was no attempt, I don't think, other than that like I say, that possible sort of mishmash of assorted blended Polynesianness. There didn't seem to me, at least, and again, you know, it could be white privilege speaking, I don't know, but there didn't feel like an attempt to sanitize it or whiten it too much. To me, it felt reasonably authentic.
Yeah. In a Disney way, I thought it did a pretty good job.
such a qualification writing at the end, in a Disney way.
Well, you know, as you rightly said, I mean, if you look at other things that they've done, I mean, there've been a number of other films that deal with, as you said, Steve, princesses from other cultures, Pocahontas, Mulan, which was set in China, attempts to try and sort of bring another culture to light. But I think this went a lot further than those other films did.
So I'm thinking tickets are going to get bought here, aren't they?
I think, I would. I think so. I think you would want to see this. I think you're going to enjoy it, for a number of reasons. And it's beautiful to look at. I only saw it in 2D, and I thought the visuals were really striking. To see it in 3D would be
could be something a bit special, wouldn't it? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, oh, that's good. So, look, we both got a lot out of Moana. There's another kids' movie I haven't seen, Steve. I don't think I'm going to be revving up to see this one. In fact,
That was unforgivable.
I gather your interest in monster trucks might have stalled in first gear.
Oh, dear. Your puns are nearly, but not quite, as unforgivable as the bloody film was.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Let's get this out of the way as quickly and as painlessly as possible. It's rubbish. It's absolute nonsense. It's complete and utter pants. You've got an evil drilling corporation drilling evilly, as evil corporations do for oil somewhere in a Dakota somewhere. And when they're drilling, they manage to somehow drill up a big, vaguely octopus-ish creature that lives in the oil. And rather than dying, as you'd imagine it would in an entirely new environment, it suddenly finds itself more at home in the engine compartment of a truck that's being rebuilt by Trip, played by Lucas Till. So you've got a truck with a monster in it. And apparently, that was the pitch that was come up with by the director's four-year-old child.
Wow. Apparently. Now, there's a rock-solid premise for you. Yeah. Okay.
It's a truck powered by a monster, hence monster trucks. And the plural comes from the fact that toward the end, two more monsters appear, and I won't even waste your time trying to tell you how they got there, because, frankly, I was losing the will to live about half an hour into this film. It is atrociously bad. Rob Lowe really ought to know better. Seriously, yeah, I mean, he probably needs the money to pay to have his massive amounts of plastic surgery reversed, and that's why he's doing this. Danny Glover should be ashamed of himself.
Danny Glover's in this.
Danny Glover, again, playing what I hinted at before when we were talking about Moonlight, the magical black friend.
Yeah.
Who exists only to crop up every now and then to serve the interests of Trip. The only decent acting in the film, and I felt sorry for her, I really did, was you'll never guess what happens. I mean, there's a nerdy girl who really has the hots for Trip. You'll never guess where that story goes, because it's completely original and innovative how they develop her character.
Oh, I wonder what happens.
Yeah, exactly. Played by Jane Levy, who was brilliant in an American sitcom called Suburgatory. If you've not seen that one, look it up. It's gone away now, but when it was on TV, it was really sharp, and she played a very, very intelligent, interesting character. She's a complete drip in this, but she still manages to find the only redeeming features in the film, and trust me, there are very few. I'm gonna leave it there. Do not see this. Do not encourage them. Apparently, Paramount Pictures took a $140 million write-down on a film a couple of years ago, knowing it was going to make no money, and it's believed that it was this one. I hope so.
Yeah, okay. I'm not inclined to spend any money there. Hey, but just quickly, Steve, because there was one other film you saw, because the preview was ages ago, I couldn't get to it. Just quickly tell me about Edge of 17.
Right, Edge of 17 with
Woody Harrelson.
Was definitely better. It's a bit flimsy. It's a bit throwaway. And again, it's a bit cliche-ridden. The basic story is this. Hayley Steinfeld plays Nadine, an angst-ridden teenage girl with basically one friend in high school. Friend starts going out with her brother. Their relationship breaks down, and it's how she tries to recover from that. It's a nice, sort of interestingly done coming-of-age kind of film. Woody Harrelson is without doubt the best thing in it as the teacher that she turns to as her confessor, who pretends to have absolutely no interest in her whatsoever and dismisses her with tart little jibes, but obviously has a heart of gold. He's brilliant. Everything else is adequate and decent. It's not bad, but it's... I mean, let's face it. What is it about American teenage girls that they are all so utterly, utterly angst-ridden and self-absorbed? They all are, and that's what she is. But, you know, Hayley Steinfeld managed to put a little bit of warmth, a little bit of character into it. It's not bad. It really isn't bad. Far from brilliant. Buy a ticket if you're bored.
Okay, thanks. I'll pass. But thank you.
I didn't oversell it then, did I? No.
No, you didn't. But it was better than Monster Trucks, so it's got to be good.
Look, I had a really bad cold earlier in the month. That was better than Monster Trucks. Monster Trucks was unforgivably bad. I didn't pay for the ticket. I still want my money back.
Yeah, oh no. Oh, that's a good line. Can I use that one day?
Please do. Yes, I'm sure I've used it before. Yes, so listen, look, I having had those memories dredged up again, I need something to cheer me up. Tell me about Nick Cave.
Okay. Well, Nick Cave is a change of tack. Maybe not a cheering change of tack. I've got a friend, Graham, who's called Graham. You're Steve and he's Graham. And Graham was telling me a week or so back, Steve, about how
tell me about Graham, Simon.
Graham has been a fan of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds for years, and he's seen him a few times, and he had tickets to his Auckland show, but his wife was away for work, Claire, so he said, "Hey, Greg, Simon, you come along to Nick Cave." And I thought, well, I've heard about Nick Cave for literally decades. I mean, he's an Australian, and he's been here lots of times. I've got this image in my mind about him being a sort of a vaguely alt-punkish, moody, dark artist, but a compelling one probably, but I'd never really listened to his music, Steve. That's a terrible thing to admit, but I hadn't, and I thought, well, this is my chance, let's grab it. So went to the Victor with Graham, and we weren't up the front, we're sitting centrally but at the back, and Nick Cave, who's 59 years old, has just put out a new album only a few months ago, and used this tour obviously to promote that album and to play most of it, put on a really, how to sum it up, this is not light throwaway entertaining pop. Okay?
No, it doesn't sound like it.
No, he is a intelligent, incisive poet, really. He writes, I think he writes poetry and sets it to music, which is at times dark and pulsing and dramatic swirling tones and, you know, keyboard pulses and not a lot of guitar, keyboard, violin is there to great effect. The first song was called Anthracene, which is from his new album, which had a line, "All the things we love, we lose." And,
that's cheering.
That's cheering. And it did turn out, as Graham told me, that shortly before he actually went into the studio to record this latest album, which is called Skeleton Tree, very sadly, his teenage son died, and this was back in 2015. So that you can only wonder how that might have affected the process.
That
so this
must
is
inform the process, sure.
Yeah, and so there are some. I think he's not a light-handed performer in any event, but this would have added even greater depth to it. The title, there's a song called Distant Sky, and this title track, Skeleton Tree, are very heartfelt, soulful songs, and this soulful but cerebral as well, Steve, which is kind of interesting. His poetry, it's all about life and death and heaven and hell and love and loss. It's pretty strong stuff.
You've ticked most of the boxes there, to be fair.
Yeah,
you?
I know. Yeah, but there are some. It's not. But there is soul there, and he's got a song like "I Need You" and another one, "Into My Arms," which were really weren't hard songs at all. Very soft songs and delivered with a lot of emotion. This is a guy. As I said, he's 59, so he's been around a while. His voice is very strong. It's not a sweet voice, but it's got a lot of depth in it. And here's a thing that really struck me listening to him live.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, when you hear when you hear a band live, I mean, obviously you're hoping that the people mixing the sound are doing a good job, and so you can hear what's going on. But he enunciated really clearly. You really could hear his words.
Oh, wow.
And I know that's a silly thing to say, but given that I think this is a guy who's obviously put a lot of himself into what he's writing, it was as if he was saying to us, not only do I care about what I'm writing about,
yeah,
I want you to hear it. I really want you to hear it. I'm going to try really hard so you can hear these words that I've written. And so apart from some choruses where the band's really kicking in and there's a big crescendo, you really hear what's going on. And I really valued that. It was he's an interesting character. He's tall, very lean, thick black, slicked back hair. He kind of looks like a bit of a willow tree as he moves around the stage, and his arms billow out. And
right.
Every now and then he'll snap his body as if there's been jolted by electricity when there's a big crashing chord or something. But
yeah.
He would talk to the audience, get into in conversations with them. He asked for some requests. He's a thinking man's, rock performer. You're not going to go there. If you're after ABBA or Kylie Minogue, not a million miles from that. But if you're after something with a degree of Well, I hesitate to use the word seriousness, but someone who really treats their art seriously, yeah, and comes up with maybe not necessarily catchy tunes, but moving tunes. And so I did enjoy it, and I would strongly recommend Nick Cave. He's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, sure, but I feel like I'm really, really glad I saw him, and I thank my friend Graham who let me go, took me along. And I'm glad I can put a tick his name next to some important artists I've seen.
Excellent.
So if he does come again, look, yep, I reckon he's worth the price of a ticket.
That's definitely a pretty unqualified positive recommendation there, isn't it? That's a fairly resounding endorsement.
I think so, yeah. But yeah, if you're just after a few a beers on a Friday night and kick your heels up, no.
No, he's not very jolly, is he? No,
no, he's not jolly. Sorry, not jolly.
Yeah.
We're at the middle of January, late January already. There's a few acts coming our way, not too far away now, Steve, huh?
This is true, yeah. I mean, the next big name to hit town is going to be Guns N' Roses.
Right, yes. Yep.
They're going to be in Auckland on the 4th, just down the road from you, in fact.
Yeah,
they're going to be at Western Spring Stadium.
Right, yes.
They're going to be in Wellington a couple of days earlier on Waitangi Day.
Yep.
One I'm really looking forward to, this is going to be so much fun. It's an odd combination, but on Valentine's Day, we've got Simple Minds and the B-52s.
Yeah, isn't that an interesting combination?
It is. I don't know who put those two together. I don't care. It's going to be a fantastic double bill. they're doing the 14th at the Vector Arena.
Yeah.
Now, we obviously you'll get cross if I don't mention yet again. yes, the man himself, Bruce Springsteen. Did you see, incidentally, that the K Street Band, the E Street Band tribute act, refused to play at Donald Trump's inauguration?
I did see that. They initially said they would, and then they realised that that would upset so many Springsteen fans, they changed their minds.
They would never recover from it. So, yes, all credit to them. They're even paying tribute to his politics.
Yes, and Bruce quite cleverly was out of the country during Trump's inauguration. I think he's already doing rehearsals in Perth at the start of his tour.
Yes.
You want to get away from it.
Yes, he's probably like a four-year-long international tour, which will bring him to Auckland, Mount Smart Stadium, 25th of February.
And I think Christchurch is, earlier in that week. So
yes, the 21st.
Yes. Now, Steve, just quickly, in terms of movies, when I was watching the movies we've been talking about today, there were a few films that were trailered, which looked interesting. One of them looks, I hear it's really good, and it's a story I had never heard about. Hidden Figures is the name of the story.
Oh, this looks so good, yes.
About three black women who actually made a huge contribution to NASA, putting John Glenn, the first astronaut, into space for the Americans.
Yeah, I'm a science teacher in high school in South Auckland when I'm not devoting my energies to Crave. And I spend an awful lot of time reminding the girls, especially in my physics classes, that for the longest time, women were kept in the background and not allowed to do science or only allowed to do science under the sufferance of male supervision. And I always point out that basically the only reason I can possibly think for this is that the fellas couldn't stand the competition.
You're probably right, you know.
Because you look at characters like these three women, without whom there would have been no space program.
Yeah.
But whose story is never told. And so, yeah, it's fantastic that it is getting told.
Yeah, and just from the look of the trailer, it looks like it's a pretty decent telling as well. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. I think it's coming out the next little while. It's not too far away, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, cool. All right. Well, look, that's great.
At the other end of the spectrum, we have to mention, since we're talking about uplifting films about empowering women.
Yes.
Have you had your invite for 50 Shades Darker yet?
Yes.
I'm not.
I saw it, but have not responded.
Yes. Did you see the first one?
No. I couldn't bring myself to really go and see it. I probably should have, but I hadn't read the book. Had you read the book? I hadn't, and I've
read the book because partly out of curiosity. I'd heard how bad it was, and it was worse than I imagined. And the film isn't even bad. The film doesn't even manage to be bad.
Oh, it doesn't manage to be bad. Okay.
No, it's just dull.
Oh, that's worse.
I could have made a better film.
Mm.
It is flat. It is boring. It is tedious. It doesn't even manage to be bad. The books are so bad they're brilliant.
Right.
The film is just atrociously boring, except for like two or three scenes, and not even the scenes you'd imagine. There's a couple of scenes when you think, okay, someone's actually making a film here. The rest of the time, it's as though they just happen to have the camera rolling while people were just chatting. It's dull. Desperately dull.
So yeah, you're not selling volume two to me here very well, Steve.
Oh no, look, I figure if I have to go, then you might as well come along as well. Just to... but it's the kind of film where you can't, you're terrified to make eye contact with anyone during it.
Yeah, oh gosh.
Absolute nonsense. So those are the ones that are coming up in the very near future. There's a few others coming up. One thing that's not coming up, we might as well mention this because we're not supporting the Laneway Festival that's coming up this weekend because they didn't give us review tickets. So we're not going to say anything positive about it at all, even though it is coming up next weekend in Auckland and will probably be the big music festival of the year. Obviously, we can't find anything good to say about it. It is worth mentioning that the headline act, or one of the main attractions, Young Thug, has pulled out.
Ah.
Couldn't get a visa for Australia, and let's face it, you know, why would you bother coming to New Zealand?
You'd like to think we've gone beyond those days and we're somehow seen as the little cousin across the ditch. But I think for some of those promoters overseas, that's still how they see us, which is very sad.
It is a bit, isn't it? Yes. But apparently, you know, the visa didn't come through for Aussie. And so after massive hype that Young Thug is playing Laneway,
as John Cleese would have said.
I think he probably got word that we weren't going to be there.
Probably. And he thought, well, if Crave isn't going to be there, then...
Then it's just not worth it, is it? Why bother?
Exactly.
Speaking of Laneway, let that be a warning to you.
You don't know how influential we are.
Absolutely.
But we might wrap this up having said all that now, but we'll be back.
We will.
But if you want to get in touch with us in the meantime, please do so. We'd like to hear from you and hear what you've got to say about what we've got to say about things. You can email us. The email address is podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook or you can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
You can. So, I am Simon Mercer.
And I'm Steve McCabe.
Yes, and that's what's been entertaining us this week.
Outstanding.